Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast that really is just taking a nosedive at this point. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kaniguser.
Yeah, so, if you've listened to the first two episodes of the show, thank you for returning for this third one.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope you enjoyed our nuanced conversations of the complexities of a Ford Coppola movie and the political subtext and nuance of a independent film dealing with some heavy, heavy issues, because today we're not doing that.
I disagree with you there, David. I think our movie today is very concerned with politics. And, you can argue that it's made by an artisanal filmmaker, someone with a unique sense of style. And if nothing else, it's just flat out bonkers, so hopefully the next hour is going to be a breeze.
Absolutely. So yes, folks, today we are talking about Street Fighter. And specifically, we're talking about Street Fighter 1994, not to be mistaken with any other Street Fighter films. The Steven E. D'Souza classic, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme and Raul Julia, which, by the way, I guess this brings us back to a point that we brought up last episode, which is the pronunciation of his name.
Go on.
Because the thing is one of the things I did in preparation for this episode was listen to the commentary track for the director, which was recorded back for the Laserdisc release of Street Fighter in the mid-90s. And throughout the entirety of that commentary track, he refers to him as Raul Julia. So, again, I almost wonder, it's like, I have to assume Steven E. D'Souza isn't trying to be a jerk, and is either, you know, Raul Julia either was too polite to never correct him.
I can see that. Just yeah. The smile and nod every time they do a script read.
Yeah, or this actually was the pronunciation of his name. I still don't have a confirmation on this. So what do you think, Andrew? Should we stick with our Raul Julia or Raul Julia?
I'm going to say speak from the heart, because I know that, my man Raul looking down on us, that's what he would have wanted. But also, I would say that given the way that this film depicts internationalism and a world that is not America, I wouldn't necessarily trust Steven E. D'Souza's capacity for tolerance.
That is also a very, very good point.
Hey, if he gets mad and corrects us, well, it's just more clicks for us.
Fair enough.
But that might be a good through line. Who, David, is Steven E. D'Souza?
So Steven E. D'Souza is a longtime screenwriter and producer who worked on any number of the action shows of the 1980s, and probably became best known working on 48 Hours, the Walter Hill classic. Also writing, being involved in the writing of a little film called Die Hard.
Still the best Christmas movie ever made.
Exactly. And he is somebody who, he's one of the key architects of 1980s action cinema when you really get down to it, just based on the credits he has and the number of people he's been involved with, including, as we sort of note here, Walter Hill, John McTiernan. I believe he also worked on the screen script for Commando.
Yes, he did.
Work on Lara Croft Tomb Raider, or the sequel, at least, I think.
Temple of Light? Or no, Cradle of Justice or something like that.
The Cradle of Life. So there we go. Also, he would go on to write a little film called Knock Off. And a personal favorite for those of us who listen to our old show, 24 Panels, Judge Dredd, the 90s version, not the superior film starring Carl Urban and written by Alex Garland. Steven E. D'Souza has a long, long history with the action genre. And with Street Fighter, he took the jump into directing. But that's not the only component of this film that's of interest, is it, Andrew?
If I could cut in there, David, it would seem odd, I think at first glance, to be like, okay, career screenwriter, suddenly being tapped to direct in his debut, like, what? Maybe not necessarily big budget, but a high-profile film. Certainly by 1994, Street Fighter II, there's a reason that people still yell Hadouken and things like that in just common parlance. It's definitely a game that has made an impact, and back when arcades were still a thing, you can see why they had high hopes for it. But also, like, D'Souza as a screenwriter, it's not like Shane Black or something like that, where they always bring a very specific sensibility and work within a very particular mode. Like, looking over D'Souza's filmography, certainly as a writer, I'm kind of astounded by the fact that, yeah, he was able to kind of change with the times pretty well. Because, like, 48 Hours basically invents, like, the action comedy in some respects. Commando is a return to, like, the reactionary sort of feminist response, double down on heteromasculinity. And Die Hard, even though everyone thinks I'm being ironic when I talk about it, like, it is my favorite action movie because it's a story of Bruce Willis learning to be a new kind of man. And so in that regard, when you're thinking, okay, well, who's going to tell a story based on a video game involving all these different characters who have to come together for something? You know, in that regard, it kind of makes sense because he's a guy that's capable of juggling multiple balls in the air, I guess.
Well, it's the thing. I mean, when we call him or when I refer to him as an architect of 1980s action cinema, I mean, he sets a template, I think is the best way. You're right. He doesn't have as distinctive a voice as, say, Shane Black, who, when you hear a Shane Black script or you read one, you know what you're getting out of it. Steven E. D'Souza is very much a meat and potatoes, but he is one of the things, whatever you may think of the majority of the films he's cranked out, and let's be honest, he's turned out some pretty bad movies. You know, as sort of tight economical pulp, you know, he's really good at it. And I mean, Die Hard is one of those films, when you look at it, is so tightly constructed, structurally, and in terms of the dialogue, and in terms of the characterization that's going on, and a lot of that is contributed to, you can contribute to the script that he worked on for that film. Likewise, films such as The Running Man, which
Oh,
by all accounts,
yeah.
yeah, should not be nearly as good as it is, given A, how much it veers away from its source material,
And in
but
some
B, to the
respects, I think that makes an improvement in some areas.
There are improvements. I mean, it's one of those very unique cases of an adaptation of adapting a very unique source material into a very unique film that is distinctly different from that source material. But in both cases, I mean, they are very, very, you know, well, tightly constructed, very well executed, straight ahead adventure movies. Again, you're not necessarily going to be getting any complex, nuanced, you know, thoughts or supreme innovation in the same way that you get from, say, Shane Black, or when Edgar Wright, you know, you look at his Baby Driver from this year and the sort of formalistic stuff that's going on with that movie. You don't get that with D'Souza, but what you get with D'Souza is real solid craftsmanship
Yeah, he's
within
like
a
a
genre.
clockwork filmmaker in that sense, where, you know, it's sort of standardized to a degree, but everything just works around a central idea pretty efficiently.
Yeah, exactly. And when you see the films of his that haven't worked, I mean, number one, there's always the question as to how much you can blame the screenwriter and how much was interference or other material things to deal with. But, you know, you look at things such as, you know, Hudson Hawk. Not a great movie, but it's an interesting one, well worth talking about. And likewise, Judge Dredd. Not a great film, but man, is it fascinating to watch and come away from. And there's some really great dialogue in both those films.
See,
That's
I'm
really
glad you
worth considering.
signposted that because watching this movie, Street Fighter, I remembered it being like garish and bad and dumb from like the last time I saw it when I was 16 or whatever. And this time around, I developed a pretty strong fondness for it because, yeah, there are all these little pockets where this film is actually doing some pretty fascinating things, and there are some amazing moments of dialogue here. But
Absolutely,
I
yeah.
guess, though, I guess steering back to the framework, so Steven DeSouza, he gets the call. Capcom, the developer behind Street Fighter, they want to get a movie made. So what happens then?
Well, specifically what happens is, I mean, and this sort of brings us to two things. One, the origin of this film is essentially Edward Pressman, a very noteworthy and high-profile producer of films throughout the 80s, 90s, and I believe into the 2000s. I still think he's working as well. Probably not as big a name as, say, a Joe Silver, but or Joel Silver, but, I mean, still noteworthy. He basically, Capcom was in Hollywood at that point taking meetings for all sorts of reasons. And Edward Pressman basically contacted D'Souza with the request that, look, if I can get a deal made with them before they go back to Japan, you know, I think I have a really good shot at getting the rights to this thing. Can you help me out and create a story overnight? And when I say overnight, I mean literally. Stephen E. D'Souza had one night to come up with a story to pitch to the Capcom executives.
See, in my mind's eye, like, D'Souza just rolls up his sleeves, cracks his knuckles, puts the ashtray on the desk, and the next thing you know, he's walking into that office.
Pretty much. And, you know, he agrees to this with the proviso that if this happens, if he does this, he's allowed to direct if the film goes forward. And to everybody's credit, this seems to be one of those cases where a deal was made based upon, you know, verbal agreements, and it happened exactly like that. They went in, Capcom support, you know, was pleased enough to sign over the rights, and they were off and running. And the film ended up being a Japanese-American co-production. I believe Capcom put up a substantial amount of the money to help make this film. And they were...
And it all just went smoothly from there, right?
Sort of. So I guess this does bring us into the other component of why this film is fascinating. Because as we're getting into this, this isn't just a simply a case of an action director making an action film. Because as we've already sort of noted here, this is a film based off a video game. And when this film goes into production and eventually it's released in 1994... We're really, really very much at the beginning of the adaptation of video games to cinema at this point in time. So we're sort of really at something that to this day is still, it's not like comic book cinema where there seems to be, you know, now a steady glut of these things and where they've sort of almost seemed to have cracked the code for the most part. Video games have proven to be one of the trickiest things to put on film, and this is right near the beginning of that. But that's not all, because this is also a case where this is a film being made at a very particular political moment as well, in the sense that this is post-Cold War America.
And more specifically, post-Gulf War as well.
Exactly. And one of the big things that we kind of need to remember when the Gulf War happened, this, while Vietnam is more... probably more infamous for, you know, America getting, you know, footage of the war direct from news sources and how that sort of changed perceptions of American perceptions of warfare. The Gulf War was pretty much the first live televised war.
The TV war, you know, that's what Baudrillard's talking about when he says the Gulf War never really happened, only because we saw it entirely mediated through images. You know, the whole idea of like, oh, well, the United States Air Force, we found a way to put cameras on top of bombs. So we can actually follow with a POV shot of a bomb landing on a target. And so much of the technological innovations that they had in warfare were really geared more towards how that war can be presented. So yeah. I think from the Gulf War onward, like, a particular aesthetic of warfare emerges, and like a certain almost like core of images come with that as well.
Precisely. And this is also the case where this is the war, you know, this is one of the first wars or war to really be covered during the 24-hour cable news cycle as well, where we suddenly, you know, we can be getting a steady stream of this information and of these kinds of images, along with embedded reporters in units to document what's going on. So, you know, so when we look at this, we have a film that is an adaptation of fighting game.
Mm-hmm.
From an architect of one of the 80s action cinema, hard R 80s action cinema, I might add. And the immediate aftermath of the Gulf War. And all these films, all these elements come together in what is ostensibly, I think, it's hard not to say, is really a children's movie in some ways.
Yeah, it's so weird because the film's tone vacillates so readily between, you know, just very, like, groan-inducing jokes and sight gags to all of a sudden, like, making, like, very polemical arguments against the idea of, like, internationalist intervention or quiet diplomacy and things like that. And, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the dilemma I can certainly see in the early 90s of making a video game movie, because realistically, the kids who were putting their quarters on in the arcade to play Street Fighter 2, the people who would be most likely to go see this film, are too young to understand, like, the overtones of it. But I think any adults who are going to buy tickets to this are going to be put off by just how kid-friendly it is. It's not that it's a toyetic film, but it's stylized in a very marketable way, I guess.
It is very, very much, in many cases, I mean, I to put this right out there, in terms of the visual design of this movie, as it relates to the very bright and colorful game it's based off of, this is a remarkably faithful adaptation in some regards.
Mm-hmm.
Because for those who, and I guess this is one of the things we should probably know, Andrew, what is the game Street Fighter 2, specifically 2, not the first one, the second game, about?
Well, Street Fighter 2, I mean, the simple answer is it's really about street fighting. Emma Bison, which is also interesting there, don't let me forget. Emma Bison is this mysterious, effectively a warlord who, depending on some translations, he either runs the country of Shadowlou or Shadow Law, which also varies, or it's this this sort of multinational terrorist cell that he controls. And once a year, he sets up the Street Fighter tournament where the best fighters from around the world will compete, and the winner will receive, like, a prize of their choosing. So later games in the franchise, like, they're still making Street Fighter games now. Canonically, they're up to 5, but they've had spin-off series, they've had manga adaptations, they've had anime adaptations, they've had, yes, as David pointed out, 2 live-action American adaptations. So the canonical world has been fleshed out sizably, but none of that was really there at the time of this film. So, I mean, there's the first challenge that D'Souza had to face, where, okay, well, everybody likes Street Fighter. How do we actually make a movie out of this?
And, yeah, the basic approach he ends up taking is it becomes, basically, as we've sort of been acknowledging here, a military intervention movie. Almost G.I. Joe-esque, which, you know, has led to rumors that this was at one point supposedly a script for a G.I. Joe film. But apparently that was not the case. It was just that, you know, D'Souza, as he notes on the commentary track, apparently that was kind of the direction that Capcom was already planning to take the franchise in anyways. So it just sort of dovetailed nicely for those purposes. And
yeah, and like with the bare bones of sort of the story framework in the game, like, this film isn't entirely out of step with that, because at heart, you know, the film proper concerns the mad warlord Bison, played by Raul Julia, who has kidnapped a bunch of aid workers from the AN, the Allied Nations, and has given the world 72 hours to provide him with $20 billion, or he will kill them all. The AN forces commander on the ground, Colonel William Guile, played by Jean-Claude Van Damme, basically is the man tasked with finding a way to find out where Bison is and bring him down and bring the hostages back home.
Yeah, and this film very quickly will establishes its tone in the opening minutes of this film. Because, you know, again, credit where credit's due. Is sort of noting that Gulf War influence. The opening of this movie is basically military footage from warfare. As we hear newscasters from around the world establishing what is going on down in Shadaloo, and basically the warfare going on between the AN forces, which, funny enough, was supposed to be the UN, except Capcom was very insistent that apparently D'Souza and company get approval from the UN to use their name, which they promptly rejected, even though by no account did they actually have to ask for permission on this.
Yeah. Though, remember, they granted permission to film at the UN building for the movie The Interpreter. So it's weird. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't say that that movie is any better than Street Fighter. But yeah, the opening sequence, like, the credit sequence is amazing. And I don't mean that, like, it's amazing how bad it is or it's bonkers or that. It is such an efficient and effective way of introducing the plot, because you're right, we go from newscasters around the world, and on the one hand, it's like, it's showing the profound effect that Bison has had on, you know, destabilizing the globe, but at the same time, it's so shrewd because it also gives you every piece of crucial information that you need to know. And then they explain Bison's exploits, and then we have news footage of Colonel William Guile, and they talk about him while cutting between the two men in their own spaces as they're listening to these reports. And, like, I'd be very curious to watch this with our friend and colleague Drew Jeffries, because he's all about remediation, where one text, one medium will appear in another and they'll inform one another, because this opening sequence is that to a T.
Well, and this is the thing. You could honestly sit there and say that, you know, there's very little actual street fighting in this movie. But by God, if you wanted to say that this is a film about media warfare, literally this film opens. The first time we're introduced to William Colonel Guile, it is intrepid news reporter Chung Lee.
Played by Ming-Na.
Yeah, Ming-Na Wen, who probably most famous these days for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., interviewing him, and basically Guile's immediate action is to taunt Bison by flexing his biceps.
Yeah, it's like he's cutting a pose, looking directly in the camera, and, you know, Van Damme, Guile, who's also the one identifying feature of him from the video games, is that he's an American. And we have the world's most famous Belgian doing all of his lines, staring at the camera, immediately, like, cutting a wrestling promo on him. And they're basically fighting through a television camera.
Yeah, and Bison actually cuts through to start challenging Guile on air as well, and announcing his demands to the world. And it's like, right off the bat, this is fascinating in terms of how the media is influencing the entire plot of this movie and works into its themes as well. But it's also firmly establishing the absolutely cartoonish tone that this movie has. Because again, our general here calls out a warlord by flexing his biceps. Like, I cannot emphasize that enough here, folks.
Well, and that's sort of where, like, the childlike sensibility comes from, where it's like, they talk about all these horrible things Bison's done, and yes, it's a hostage ransom plot set up, but Bison is also demanding the ridiculous amount of $20 billion, and Guile's solution for that is like, nope, not we're going to keep our plan secret, we're going to coordinate some airstrikes, we're going to impose sanctions. He basically grabs a microphone and says, look, come find me, and I'm going to fight you one-on-one, and I'm going to beat you up, and that'll be the end of that.
Exactly. And you cut to, every time you cut to Bison's lair, which is this, I mean, D'Souza admits as much, it's a Bond villain lair, if
oh,
there ever
quite
was
quite clearly.
Yeah, which is like, he's got this giant center of media banks with this magic floating platform that he's always riding around in. And this is all built within what is supposedly like a sacred temple of some anonymous religion that we never find out about. It just goes on like this. It's like, and it's like, it's so, like, within the first 10 minutes, they have established the completely bonkers tone of this movie. And it just snowballs from there. And we haven't even gotten into the variety of subplots and side quests and other stuff.
But that's the thing, because when you say side quest, it almost makes it sound like it's the B story happening in an episode of a sitcom. Everything is logically connected to this opening sequence in a way, because Chun-Li, the newscaster that in the opening scene, she's basically a prop to witness this shouting match. And then Guile basically says, "You are almost useful for a second." It's like, what does that even mean? Why are you being a jerk for literally no reason? But we find out that she has her own vested interest in taking down Bison, and at the same time, we discover Ryu and Ken, which is interesting. American kids always call him Ryu, but the Japanese is Ryu. The film, depending on the actor, they call him both. Did you notice that?
Yeah, it was throwing me for a while first. There, it's like, okay, did they could they just not decide, or did it, no, were they just not given direction? What was going on
Well,
there?
yeah, but like the two most iconic characters from the video game, Ryu and Ken, are basically the side characters here, where they're basically like con men, and then it turns out that they're trying to burn Sagat, who's Bison's go-to arms supplier, and then through that, everybody ends up meeting together, and like it connects. I mean, there's no great leap of logic. There's baffling decisions and curious choices, but in terms of like looking at the plot as a structure, everything makes total sense.
No, you're absolutely right. It does. It's just that then you get to when you start getting into the minutiae of the details of this film that it gets a little crazy because you get things such as, again, as we noted, Chun-Li has this whole backstory about her father having, been murdered by Bison when they were trying to drive him out of their village that he was attacking. And her solution is she has trained herself, much like Batman, to get revenge. But her choice for getting close to Bison and defeating him was, after having mastered martial arts, was to become an embedded journalist in a war zone for a CNN-like news broadcaster. And she is joined by, as part of her revenge squad, a boxer Balrog played by the absolutely delightful, really wish he was still working, Grandel Bush, and E. Honda, a sumo wrestler, a disgraced sumo wrestler, both of whom Bison had disrupted their careers,
Yeah, they wouldn't
which
play
does.
ball with Shadow Lu, so they got them blacklisted.
Which I love the notion that apparently Bison's evil schemes range from like global domination to like the most petty
Yeah,
things. It's
fixing
like, well,
martial
this.
arts fights. But that's what I love
It's.
about that sequence, because Honda's like, what's your beef with Bison? He's like, I could have been Yokozuna, and then he ruined my career. And then Balrog just pauses and goes, yeah, me too.
Exactly.
It's like,
It's just
oh, okay then.
like. So, two former sports stars who've apparently decided that the next logical career decision was to get involved as
Yeah,
cameramen in
let's
a news
also be
broadcaster.
journalists. And like, but that's the thing with the moment that like early on we see that turn where Chun-Li isn't your regular news anchor. She's sneaking around like a ninja, infiltrating things and knocking out bad guys. It's like, at no point did you ever need to like go to journalism school and work on the International Affairs Bureau. It's like, maybe she wanted a fallback? That is not easy to do.
Exactly. I mean, it's absolutely stunning the goofy logic that it takes to get here, and yet it kind of works. I mean, as long as you're on its wavelength, it's really, really enjoyable. But then you're right. You have that sort of through line to the film. You have Colonel Giles. Challenge, which I funny enough, what kind of throws me about this film again is kind of interesting structurally is that Guile is technically the lead hero of the film, and he spends the majority of it, basically at his base
Yeah,
while
doing
other
very
people,
little.
yeah, doing very little because the film ends up using again utilizing what ends up happening is Ken and Ryu, end up after getting caught by Sagat, who's about to force them to fight his Vega, his cage fighter, which leads to one of the many, many great lines that Wes Studi gets to speak throughout this movie.
I think we're thinking of the same one.
He was the best fighter since Iron, what was Iron Fist, or?
Yeah, it's, who's Vega? He's the best fighter since Iron Fist. And who's Iron Fist? Or what happened to Iron Fist? He retired, and then he became me.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, he says it so solemnly and, like, without a trace of irony. And, like, oh, I just... That's the tendency of this film. It'll do something really brilliant and immediately undercut it by something stupid.
Yeah, because what ends up happening is they all get arrested with Guile just bursting in a tank and saying, just announcing to the entire crowd at this illegal cage fight, you're all under arrest. Which leads to an entire situation in which Ken and Ryu agree to basically help Guile stage his death, which they will then spread through the media, as reported by Chung Li, to trick Bison into thinking he's dead, to integrate themselves into his base, so that they can track them and eliminate them. Except, of course, Chung Li ends up becoming involved in sort of sabotaging some of their plans and getting in her own quest for revenge. And meanwhile, while all of this is going on, Bison is also, you know, basically taking Guile's one friend, Carlos Blanca.
Charlie!
Yeah, Charlie. Which, and having Dr. Dalsim start, you know, against his will, mutating his body via the power of green and orange Kool-Aid.
Yeah, they wheel out a hospital rack, and on it is, like, neon bags labeled DNA mutagens. It looks like washer fluid.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the tone of this film. If it were to be made now, like, or if someone like Christopher Nolan were to make it, there would be, like, a 20-minute scene where they talk about how, no, there's real science that suggests this could happen. This is the kind of film where it's like, we need to mutate this guy. Here, we'll hook him up to these mutagens, and that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, it's ridiculous, it's goofy, and, I mean, when you start seeing how they're just using, you know, historical footage of various, you know, real-life conflicts to brainwash, to quote-unquote program Blanca, I'm not really sure how that works, but, again, you go with it because, sure, why not?
Yeah, this will make someone into the perfect soldier. Making him wear terrible green makeup and look like a rejected takes from the movie Mask. Okay, let's try and rein it in, because there's a lot going on in this film. And given like commentary tracks and production histories, that wasn't really meant to be the case. I remember back in, like, 1997, reading an interview with Steven DeSouza in PC Gamer, and one thing that's always stood out was he talked about when he was writing the script, he wanted to have, like, six core characters that he would develop. And then he had his first draft of the script, Capcom immediately turned around, and they were like, no, there needs to be at least 14.
Yeah.
So the opening aspects of this film is so weird, because, like, there are all these characters that are thrown in simply so they can reference this quota, where it's like, you know, there will be lines that are said in a way that you can tell they're thrown in there so everyone in the theater can go, look, it's that guy. Where, like, Han is, you know, finding that there's signal interference with the camera, and he's like, I can't get this to work. Can you, Balrog? And, like, it becomes a game of spot the character at first.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's one of those things that it should really overwhelm and harm the film. And yet, credit where credit's due. I mean, I'm sure that, I mean, and I guess this will bring us sort of into the question of, you know, video games being adapted to the film. But if you're somebody who's coming to this without having, say, a favorite character from the game, here the actual balance of screen time isn't that bad between them all.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which, you know, characters are deployed and appear in the film is, you know, actually works reasonably well. Like, I mean, you've got Vijay as Bison's right hand man from Microsoft.
Yes.
who, again, I mean, Miguel A. Nunez Jr., I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it right, Again, he makes such a great foil for Raul Julia in this film. There is just a, you know, a moment where, well, the whole scene we'll get to eventually, the Bisonopolis speech and how it opens. Mm-hmm. His comic timing is perfect in those scenes, and he's got tons of great stuff going on there.
And like, yeah, we've seen movies with ensemble casts before, and they run into the problem where, well, hey, it's all your favorites, but no one really has anything to do. Like, even a character like Zangief, you know, who's just the lumbering muscle, he maybe has, like, 5 minutes of screen time, and, like, everybody just sort of makes it all count. And, like, in some respects, the characters in this film, there's, like, four times as many as One from the Heart, and I think they're all fleshed out much better than anybody in that film was.
Yeah, I mean, again, they're broadly cartoonish, but they get arcs, they get, you know, development in a way that, yeah, that we don't see in a film like One from the Heart, which has about the same running length and achieves so little for that in that time.
Well, yeah, it's almost like the classic film serial structure where, you know, you go back and watch Star Wars A New Hope, and I recently revisited that one, but what strikes me is that it's such an exciting film because every scene is like a Hollywood serial, where it brings you up to speed, tells you, like, only what you absolutely need to know, get something moving, and the scene ends with, like, that micro arc settled. So something is always going on that's important. And even though it's an hour and 40 minutes, like, there's not really any points of dead time in the film.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there's stuff you could sit there and say that just sort of appears reasonably may have been set up earlier in the film, such as when the AN officials randomly show up.
At the worst possible moment.
Yeah, at the worst possible moment to, you know, basically try and undercut Guile's efforts. And, like, they appear, and then they are basically, their entire threat is made null and void 5 minutes later. But, well, 2 minutes later in, again, one of the many great speeches of this movie, but we'll get there. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, you can't complain about, you know, that stuff isn't always happening and that it isn't contributing to forwarding the narrative as we have it going on here. There was another point I was about to bring up there, but I'm completely blank. But yeah, no, to come back to your point about the, like, 16 main characters in the film, again, you know, it's one of those weird things, where one of the points I had written up here as part of our notes was the question of, when it comes to video games, and particularly a game like Street Fighter, where, again, there are, like, about 17 billion characters in which you can choose to play. When you're playing the game, one of the reasons, you know, it never... Again, I remember being a kid and playing Street Fighter 2, and I never really cared about the story, but half the fun was also realizing that, you know, whoever you choose to play as, yeah, that becomes the main character.
And they get a different ending. So even if you have no love for Dhalsim, you know, there's that impetus to play as him because, you get a bit more of the story. Same thing with Mortal Kombat and, like, the other fighters of its time, where they did just enough to keep audiences interested. But there's also, you know, especially early 90s gaming, like, now it's a bit different because with technology, like, games have really incorporated a lot of cues from cinema, specifically cinematic narrativity, through the 90s as storage gets bigger and cutscenes become a thing, you know. In fact, on my shelf right now, I have Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, which it's a wonderful game, but it's really more... Like, you'll have a brief mission, and then you'll watch 40 minutes of cutscenes, and it really does feel, like, more filmic than anything.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, like, this comes out at a time where we're in the console wars, and games really... They're narrative in the sense that they supply you with enough building blocks and structure to have some direction, but a lot of the story being told is based on the user. And that's the complete opposite of filmic narrativity, where it's purely didactic.
Yeah, and that's the thing where I've always found, like, that one of the struggles with video game adaptations is how do you make that work? And in some cases, oftentimes, the choice seems to be, particularly when it's adapting these kinds of fighting games, like Mortal Kombat makes a very conscious choice to, we're going to follow, you know, one particular character. There'll be a couple side characters who are sort of, you know, his sidekicks, as it were. But that's it. That's, I mean, basically the thing. Everybody else is sort of a glorified cameo or small bits and pieces. But whereas here, as you sort of brought up as sort of a counterpoint to what I was bringing up, Andrew, is it does somewhat feel like if you were to cut this film into separate segments, you know, that each has their own slightly distinct feel. I mean, they all unify into a whole. But, yeah, each one feels like, you know, every character has their own, or at least four or five of the main characters do have a very solid arc throughout this film that sort of becomes intertwined and is distinct from the others.
And the arcs almost, I remember your reading of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, how the different scenes of the film and like the different environments are almost linked to a different classical genre. I almost feel like the character that's the focus of the scene almost produces a different kind of action film. Certainly in the first half, I think as everything builds up to the climax and all the characters come together, that lessens a bit. But, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme, like the Guile character, his scenes are all about revenge and like taking down the big bad and sort of might makes right. As we said, the Bison scenes are straight up like Dr. No in his lair. Chun-Li's scenes are more like subterfuge, espionage investigation, more of like a thriller, I guess. And then Ryu and Ken, especially those early scenes when they're meeting up with Sagat, like that is straight up like classic HK cinema right there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, it almost feels like a crime thriller at that point, at least in the early going. Like they'd walked out off the set of Miami Vice and then suddenly ended up in a Hong Kong action movie for whatever reason. So, I mean, yeah, no, I mean, it really, you know, it's very unique how it approaches it. And I think in many ways, maybe that's kind of why this works so much better than, say, I mean, let's be honest here. I mean, like I said, this is kind of very early on in the notion of video games becoming films. And what were its predecessors? We had stuff like the Super Mario Brothers movie, which, don't get me wrong, I love that film for in all its wrongheaded, baffling glory.
For anyone listening to our podcast for the first time, I'd just like to point out David has a tendency to see the best in everything and everyone.
Not necessarily, but I mean, certainly in that case, I think it's a fascinating movie. I'm not going to make a claim that it's a good movie, much like I'm not going to necessarily claim that Street Fighter is a good movie per se. But it's fascinating. And then you get something like Double Dragon, which, no, I have nothing good to say about that one. That is just a debacle from start to finish. So, yeah, I mean, at this point in time, Street Fighter's actually kind of like light years ahead of what the competition had been.
Well, yeah, and I remember as a kid, like, talking to my friends after we forced our parents to take us to the theater, and, like, I remember a couple people being like, oh, they got the story all wrong, you know? That's not what a Street Fighter movie should be about. But it kind of begs the question, like, if you are adapting Street Fighter 2 into a movie, what's it supposed to look like? You know? And I think that's a problem that they're never really going to get around because the game itself is so amorphous. It gives you soft edges and a whole lot of space in the middle for you to fill in that, like, I think is perfectly serviceable. I mean, maybe it's a case, like, where you can only identify things for when it fails. But, like, yeah, we can be like, oh, well, if you made it like this, that's not really a Street Fighter film. But I don't know if you can, like, positively and proactively be like, no, this is the story you need to tell. So it's weird, but none of it ever seems, like, out of step or not compatible with the source material.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, I mean, it's very telling. It's one of those cases where it's not as if they went out of their way to ignore the source material because, again, they integrate a great deal of iconography and other elements of the games into the finished film. So, for example, I mean, you will see characters, you know, perform their, you know, quote unquote special moves from the game here, you know, whether it's Colonel Guile, you know, doing the backflip kick thing.
The flash kick. Hold down for 2 seconds, up, and then medium and high kick.
Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. You get Bison technically does, what was it, the Psycho Crush?
Yes.
In the old game. Yeah,
he and technically. The movie gives a rational explanation of why this man can suddenly fly.
Yeah, exactly.
I it's mean, bonkers, is, but it gives you one. That's more than the game did.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, Honda's, you know, Thousand Hand Slap, or, and again, the Hadouken actually does kind of appear in this movie in a very blink and you miss it kind of way, but it's there. And then there's even elements such as the background designs, like the, what was it? The, whenever you saw E. Honda in the game, he had that, what was it, a bathhouse?
Yeah, or it's like a spa, and it's got like this ornate mural in the background, and or in Sagat's level, how there's the giant golden woman statue, and like the elements from even the background in this, the levels themselves, which no kid is paying attention to, those elements appear in the film's mise-en-scène.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably one of my favorite touches, the point where I have to salute the production designer and everybody involved in this film, is there's a scene between Chun-Li and Bison in his boudoir, I guess is the best way to put it. And there's a hat rack. And that hat rack has all of throughout the entire film, Bison is always wearing this sort of military general style cap on his head. And there's an entire hat rack with multiple versions of that hat, but they're all the palette swaps for if you happen to select the character.
Really? I didn't notice that. That's amazing!
Yeah, I mean, it's like, again, it's such a small detail, and it's the sort of thing where it's like, that is astounding that you guys went out of your way to throw in a little nod like that throughout it. And yeah, I mean, and D'Souza admits in the commentary track, the way the film was constructed was that over the course of the film, all the characters, save for Bison, who's like in his outfit from minute one in this movie, were designed to gradually, you know, enter into their quote-unquote superhero costumes over the course of the film in what was supposed to be a sort of natural way or a sort of organic way. And yeah, it does happen. There's a reason Chun-Li ends up wearing something
or spiked
very
bracelets.
Exactly. There is, you know, as goofy as the Blanca makeup is, and by goofy, I mean terrible, you know, it's there and there's a rationale for it. Guile eventually ends up in his sort of tank top green shirt and pants with his flexing American flag tattoo.
Yeah.
On
Ryu and Ken, they end up getting their gis, you know? It's like, there's this tendency to think, especially video games, that a lot of adaptations, you know, like we mentally associate that with a cash-in. And some of them are like Double Dragon, probably a cash-in. Street Fighter, though, there's this level of attention and there's this level of care that even though the film is not a great one, and in many people's eyes, like, not even a moderately passable one, you can see that there's a lot of thought going into the composition of this film. And, like, that's just, ugh. I mean, it's one of those films where it's like, had the production been a little bit smoother? Because, I mean, there's the interference from Capcom and their own directives, interference from the studio, and the fact that Jean-Claude Van Damme, shall we say, was having a bunch of personal problems during the filming of this.
By which we mean drugs.
The problems that disappear up your nose. And also having an affair with Kylie Minogue on set, who plays Cammy. It's just, I don't know, like, I remember, like, when I sat down and watched this with my partner, we were thinking, like, all right, let's try and spot the moment where this film goes wrong, and you can't clearly point to anything. Like, it's weird, but it's holistically weird.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's one of those movies where you can see, I can see why people don't like it. I mean, it's one of those things where I understand why somebody would watch this and flat out reject it. Like, James gave up, our friend James, who I used to co-host Cinema Chase with, and we will have on the show one day. Maybe I'll, well, I won't spoil future announcements. But the point of the matter is, he gave up on this film in like 15 minutes. Because he just could not get past the design of it. He couldn't get past with the tone. And if you're not on board with that within like about the first 15 minutes, I get it. You're not going to enjoy anything else that comes after it. And it's not like this film is flawless either. I mean, some of the wire work in this movie is kind of bad.
Like a lot of the dialogue is pretty groan inducing. And, like, especially that sequence where they go to the arms bazaar, and it's a bunch of stereotypical, like, Middle East terrorists, you know, making hilarious jokes about, oh, we've got some Iraqi tanks for sale from the Gulf War. 6 speeds, 2 forward and 4 in reverse. And just, it's so totally out of place. And the radio DJ...
Yeah. Oh, which
who is the voice of the DJ in this film, David?
Let me go back to my notes because I'm trying to remember the name. But basically, it was the individual who inspired "Good Morning Vietnam."
Yes, it's Adrian Cronauer, the man himself, doing all the in betweens.
Yeah, and if you watch through the entirety of the credits, I'm at it, which we'll get to later as well. But I mean, he is cracking jokes throughout the entirety of the end credits. Up until you get to the very final, post-credit stinger at the end. You get stuff like that. And a lot of the film, it is legitimately funny, though, for all the groan-inducing stuff. You then get things such as probably the absolute highlight of this movie, which is Raul Julia's performance of the Bisonopolis speech.
Is that the one where it's, they call me a warlord. They call me a madman.
Yeah. And he gives this, it's the speech that if this had been in an Ed Wood movie, it would have been perfectly in place. And we'd be calling it one of the greatest moments of high camp awfulness ever. But God bless Raul Julia. He commits to playing this in slightly arch seriousness. And, when he starts talking about how all he wants to do, is create a superhuman soldier for good.
It'll stomp out all of his enemies and stabilize the world, and then the world can live in peace and bow at the might of Bison.
And gives us the immortal words in the loving grip of the Pax Bisonica.
Yes.
Which is so good.
And the whole time, he's standing in front of a mock-up of Bisonopolis, where he makes it a specific point to expand the food court, because all the multinational franchises are going to want to be there.
Absolutely. And this is a guy who's gone out of his way to print up his own money with his image on it.
A bison and, dollars.
And which he can guarantee will be worth 5 British pounds once they kidnap the queen.
this guy... That's so effortlessly. Sagat, he's like, this is useless. He's like, it'll be worth 5 times as much as the English pound once I kidnap the queen. It's like, this is the first we're hearing about this. How long have you been planning that?
But that's what I love. It's like he has these long range. It's not just that he has a plan. He has a long range plan. And not only does he have a long range plan, how you sit there, you listen to it, realize this guy is completely off his rocker and yet has somehow managed to amass an entire military operation totally dedicated to him for reasons unknown. And he's utterly convinced that everything's going to work out fine, which, in 2018, when you consider who is leading, quote unquote, the free world at this point, not entirely off base. Which also brings up, I love the fact that apparently the presentation of Bison in this film was influenced by Barbara Walters' interview with Gaddafi.
I can see that.
Which is just stunning.
It's just, he's a combination of like real world sort of Banana Republic general combined with Cobra Commander. And like, and that's, I think, maybe why a lot of people just can't get on board with this film, because, we begin with images of war-torn regions, and, like, the imagery that it's evoking is stuff that's from America's very recent historical memory, things that have real-world consequences, but it keeps going from that to absolute insanity. Like, the climactic fight is Bison flying around with his electromagnetic boots, shooting lightning from his hands, and by the end, literally screaming at the top of his lungs about when Lucifer fell from the heavens.
And let's not forget that his big defeat is getting roundhouse kicked into a bank of television screens, which for some reason explode afterwards. It is just...
It's... Oh, like, nothing about this film makes sense, but I think it becomes its own litmus test, where you're either on board or you're not. And I think if you're the kind of person that is on board, like, there are definitely things to point to that you can appreciate and value about it. I just feel so sad for anybody who can't get over, I'm not buying JCVD as an American or a movie based off a video game. You know, that's ridiculous because there's so much going on here. Trying to think of, like, other moments. I have, like, a whole mental list, but I think this will be, like, a 3-hour episode if we list them all. But, like, monologue about, for me, it was just Tuesday. Like,
exactly.
There are some moments where it's, like, it really does hit that sort of post-irony gap where you're, like, I can't tell if this is meant to be genuine or not, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that scene in particular, I mean, is such a great thing because you get Ming-Na, who delivers this monologue about, you know, what happened to her father and why she's become motivated. And she plays it totally straight throughout the entire scene and is just, you know, giving this, you know, this real emotion to the scene. And then you just cut to Raul Julia and his immediate response is, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's such a... there is something legitimately deflating and kind of creepy about the fact that, like, this guy just does not, you know... He's done probably so many terrible things. It legitimately doesn't matter what's, you know, most of the stuff to him.
And I mean, like, that's a very real world concept to think about, that, you know, the trauma of the individual in somebody who's responsible for overseeing chaos and brutality on a global scale, like, they don't think about the individual faces of the lives that they've destroyed, you know? But, like, Street Fighter the movie, why is this the film that's making that point? You know, it... just trying to think... Oh, I had something. It was... oh, yeah, like, another thing about Bison and just the weirdness of the character is... He's this ruthless, bloodthirsty despot. And even when, like, all the heroes are captured and he requests his private audience with Chun-Li, like, this speaks to the fundamental cartooniness of the film, where I'm like, in 2018, any movie where, like, men are asserting any kind of, like, sexualized violence or threat of violence against women, undeniably uncomfortable. And I'm like, oh, I don't remember this part. And then... at the same time, like, there's nothing untoward about the scene. Because Bison isn't leering after Chun-Li. He's not, like, throwing himself after her. It's like, he doesn't want her in an embodied sense. Instead, he puts on his robe, dims the lights, puts on mood music, gets her a drink. It's like, he's a cartoon villain in the sense where his plan, he doesn't want to have sex with her. He wants her to fall in love with him. And then after she beats him up in a fight, he's like this great warlord, and then all of a sudden there's a distraction. What does he do? He doesn't strike her. He doesn't, you know, even indirectly strike her. He scampers around the corner in the most pitiful manner possible and locks himself in a room.
Yeah, before gassing them all and then laughing maniacally. Again, almost like a Bela Lugosi in...
that shot of his face. I mean, to be fair, he was also dying of stomach cancer when they made this film. But that shot is something else.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an amazing shot. And then, you know... And again, like, Raul Julia is hands down the best thing in this movie. But then you even... like, even Jean-Claude Van Damme, who, again, for all of his issues... get some really great, genuinely funny scenes in this movie. I mean, again, as we were noting earlier, there's a scene where the AN officials say, they're going to negotiate. with Bison, and you know, answers things, and that Colonel Guile, you know, needs to stand down and, you know, send all his troops back into the base and all this. And
tell them Guile all that they can go home.
Yeah, and he proceeds to give this speech, the we can all go home speech, and basically the way the scene goes, Guile ends up convincing his entire troops, it's like, I'm not going home, I'm going to go in my boat, and I'm going to beat the crap out of Bison. And everybody decides to come with him, and you sit there and think, the sequel to this movie has to be Colonel Guile's trial.
Guile effectively becomes Bison in that scene, where he's jumping the chain of command, and he commands his own army, irrespective of government. I'm like, that's the thing, me and Kirsten, my partner, we were watching it, and that scene happens, and then we're like, wait a second, did he just engineer a mutiny? Because he totally does. Also, Dave, you're underselling that climactic monologue. It's not that he's just going to go beat up Bison. It's that he's going to get in his boat, go up the river, and kick Bison in the ass so hard that the next Bison wannabe is going to feel it.
It's true, yes. To quote more of that amazing dialogue.
But, like, that, but again, speaks to the cartoon sort of impulse where, you know, it's more complicated than just might makes right, but, you know, you have the nebbish suit type being like, oh, we're going to negotiate with Bison. And he's like, no, he did something wrong, we need to go stop him, and everyone agrees with me. So that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, and it's Simon Cowell, we should note, who's playing the AN official. And apparently, again, according to D'Souza, he really had to keep convincing him to go that much more cartoonish with his stuffy British bureaucrat.
They found the perfect guy to be an ineffectual civil servant.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's even a great joke later on where you cut back to that civil servant where he's explaining to the higher-ups, it's like, no, I stopped him from taking all the
army. My god, that's my favorite shot in the entire film.
Yeah, where you just cut back to the chef, the one person who stuck around, and I should note, that's producer Edward Pressman.
That's apparently. Edward Pressman? Yeah, the chef in the middle of an abandoned camp, stirring a pot and smoking, while a cat wanders through the background and just meows. It's like, how can you not enjoy this film? That's the thing. And like, I don't know, I think there's the risk whenever, you know, you start doing a podcast or any kind of analysis of film where, you know, people assume that you're going to skew to art or you're only going to skew to like lowbrow, like, you know, and we can all think of a bunch of podcasts that we're not affiliated with that do either or. And like, I don't know, this is one of those films that's a good reminder that it doesn't have to be art to be interesting and it doesn't have to be good to be watchable. And this movie is, there is nothing like Street Fighter, the movie.
Yeah, no, and I mean, it's one of those things where, it comes out, I honestly think that this film only exists because of that weird intersection of elements that couldn't, probably, you know, 3 or 4 years later, couldn't have happened. And a few years earlier would have been just too soon, and yet somehow it all congels into this kind of perfect late Saturday night movie that is, again, just goofy and ridiculous and fun. And I mean, you know, and I'm going to get flack for saying this, but if you're, the film, as Edward Pressman notes, they had to tone down a lot of the violence. Apparently, as he claims, there was a school shooting around the time they submitted the film to the MPAA. And that is why so much of the violence is truncated in the film. But to be entirely honest, as kind of a kid-friendly, goofy action movie, it's a good introduction point to something like that, to the action genre. Like, I would have very little issue, you know, showing Street Fighter to a younger kid, because really, what are they gonna walk away from this movie with? You know?
Yeah, like, people die, but it's not gruesome, it's not bloody, it's the kind of gun goes bang, man falls down style. And, yeah, it's just, there are, like, the sequences where it's, like, giving Ryu and Ken the tour through the refugee camp, looking at, you know, people displaced from war and that, and it's kind of upsetting, but, like, most of it remains rooted in this very, a very video game elasticity, almost.
Well, no, absolutely. And I mean, again, we should also note, I mean, you know, it's big, it's colorful. I mean, it is so, it really hits the point of being, you know, this great big goofy cartoon so early on that I can't really get offended by it. Like, I mean, it's not vulgar or, you know, unsettling in a way that like Michael Bay's Transformers films are. Like, those ones I find are just honestly reprehensible movie.
Yeah, like, just like this movie has points where it's stupid, but I mean, it's I'd rather watch a dumb movie than an offensive one.
And if we're talking about, you know, in 2018, the issue of diversity of your cast, I mean, let's talk about the fact that this is a film with a pretty broad representation throughout its entire cast. I mean, yes, ultimately our big showdown comes down to, you know, the white Belgian guy who saves the day ultimately at the end of the year. But it's not like the heroes are you know, there's characters who are pushed to the side and marginalized and don't get to do something to contributes to, you know, the resolution of this narrative. And I mean, yes, there are things where there's not so much whitewashing going on, but I think the switching of nationalities.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like Byron Mann is Chinese American. Ryu is a Japanese character. Sagat is from Thailand in the games. And West Studi, I believe, is Indigenous American.
I think so, yeah.
And I mean, and all of that's preferable, though, to just having everybody be white, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's not perfect, but I mean, again, I mean, you look at the cast they get, and I'd be hard-pressed to say that there is a bad performance, aside from maybe Kylie Minogue, and it's not so much that she's bad as she just looks really uncomfortable in this movie. Like, I'm not really sure what I'm doing here. I really don't know if this is the type of movie I'm in, but again, this is early in her acting career. I completely, you know, she's gotten better since.
I think she might have also been nervous by the fact that she was having an affair with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
That is also a distinct possibility as well. But I mean, again, you know, she, you know, there isn't really a bad cast member in this film, and everybody kind of gets their moment to shine throughout for the most part. So, I mean, you know, I give this film like a star and a half on Letterboxd, and I feel that is somehow both right and wrong because it doesn't really reflect the enjoyment I get out of it.
Well, it's like Streets of Fire, where if you're evaluating it in terms of, you know, its overall status as an art object, then yeah, probably 1.5 stars is okay. But at the same time, when you think about it, like, there's that attention to detail, and it's just so enjoyable that you can't really quantify that so easily.
No, exactly. And I mean, again, a lot of the stuff that does go on in this, I mean, it's kind of notable to see things like the post-credit stinger that promises a sequel that was never delivered. Well, so I don't know. Did you watch the after-credit scene, Andrew?
I didn't see an after-credit scene. The version I was watching, I just waited until the end of the credits, and then Adrian Cronauer stopped talking, so I assumed it was over.
Okay, basically, the final shot of the film is you cut back to Bison's base, where the sort of voiceover of the computer control center slowly comes back to life, and you see Bison's hand burst out through the rubble.
Ooh.
And then you cut to a computer screen where it is scrolling through the Microsoft Windows layout, I might note here. Again, this film's weird anti-Microsoft components to it. You know, he ends up clicks on World Domination, which it asks him replay again, and he clicks yes. Which I can't tell whether that's a promise for, you know, of a sequel or more just a nod to Raul Julia, because this is a film that was dedicated to his memory, because it did come out after he'd passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So I could honestly read that either way. I'm going to choose to read it as the more emotional of the things, or it's like, you know, here's just our nod to our fallen cast member, but...
Or maybe the entire plot of Street Fighter is simply a virtualization on Bison's computer, and that he is the only real thing about the film.
Could be.
no stranger than anything else that happens. But
Yeah.
I guess speaking of the end credits, though, Dave, I feel
Yeah.
like if left to our own devices, we can talk about this movie for days. But maybe we
Yeah.
should steer it to our classic patent pending summary section, hits and pits.
Yes.
So I wonder. So I guess with something as sprawling as this film and a conversation as sprawling as the one we've had, maybe we could do a bit more overall summary recaps on this one. But it's your pick, so I will let you go first, Dave. What is hit-worthy about this film?
One thing that I haven't really brought up here, but I'm going to give a shout out to Rossann Seth again. Hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Who plays Dr. Dalsim in the film? Now, this is one of those characters where it's the character in name only from the game, pretty much. Which may be a good thing because I've never been entirely sure whether we can read Dalsim as maybe a racist character in some ways. I totally not
Well, he
positive.
can blow fire, and with the power of yoga, he can stretch his body across the screen, so it's a little dicey.
Yeah. Having said, putting that aside, the actor's actual performance is great, particularly when he starts going for like his Oscar moments, where he just decides, no, I'm just gonna take this deadly straight. There's a wonderful scene where, you see Guile about to shoot Blanka in the head,
A mercy
as
kill.
a quote unquote mercy kill, and you just have, Seth reach in. Push Guile's hand out. It's like, no, you have no right. And it's just like, it's like he doesn't re it's like he doesn't care if it this is Street Fighter the movie. By God, he is gonna, go for that Oscar gold
Yeah, and
in
then it's
moments like
and when he walks off to his own death, where it's like, but you didn't do anything, he says. Good men doing nothing is evil enough, and then marches off to his fate. Like, oh, he really seems to be in a different movie than anybody else.
Yeah, but good on him for being so off. So what about you, Andrew? What's your first pick?
I thought I would just make a list of them, but let's just say some of the one-liners in this film that are just, even the bad ones are so amazing. Like, even when Dalsim is being sweated down by the fat old security guard, who,
Yeah.
when he delivers the classic line, "You think you're pretty smart, huh? Let's see how smart you are when you're not breathing." I would say the dialogue in this film is very unique, and at the same time, there are a number of lines that are just dropped, and you actually have to stop and reflect on for the next 5 minutes because you cannot tell if it's good or bad. So that's at least unique and distinctive. Dave, what's another hit?
Another one here. Now, what we mentioned the character's name, Zangief, who's played by Andrew Brynarski, again, hopefully I'm pronouncing that name correctly. And again, along with getting some really I mean, he's probably the most kiddish character in this film. He's like basically Bison's clunky
The simple strong man.
yeah, who, does, it's like, yes, I believe in Bison. We're doing good in the world. As he walks by, oh yeah, I should also note for the record, for those who haven't paid attention, because I didn't realize it, almost every foreign language in the film, apparently, according to D'Souza, is Esperanto, along
Which
with
is
all the,
insane.
yeah, along with all the propaganda posters in the background. So kudos to them. But no, the reason I bring up him in particular is I didn't realize it at the t when I until I went through his credits. This is the guy who played Chip, Christopher Walken's kid in Batman Returns, and he looked
Wait,
so different.
really?
And yeah, it's like he's so bulked
Wow.
up and so different looking. It's like kudos to you for the dedication, because I don't know whether he's specifically bulked up for this role, but man, I got again salutes
Yeah, he
for that
looks
kind of
the
physique.
part. We talked about the
Yeah.
300 workout. Maybe we need to get the Street Fighter workout off the ground.
Indeed. But what else, Andrew? What else have you got that's a hit here?
This one may feel like cheating, but I mean, because there's so much of this film that I really enjoy. As a banner category, I would say attention to detail. And that's not just in the sense that there are the little cues from the video game or like the little beats in the scenes that sort of make the more successful ones work, but just even there's so many like just odd little things. Like even with Zangief when he's giving them the tour of the Shadaloo base, how I didn't notice until I watched it back, but as he's leading Ryu and Ken through the place, every room they walk into, he hits his head on a light bulb. And like there's so much going on that like it's not foreground, it's not focused on. It's a thing they decided to do and just put in the movie. And then they get in the last room, and that's the one he doesn't hit on. So that means that they clearly intended this. And like, but yeah, like the cues from the games, just the attention to detail with the costume and like trying to find a plausible reason for people to be dressed like this. It's, say what you will about the end result, but like, my God, there are movies with much higher budgets and much higher expectations that do not try half as hard to like just make it work. And I guess on that note, like, we think of this movie as a colossal failure. When you factor in international gross, it basically made back 3 times its budget. So
Oh, yeah.
it did not do nearly as poorly as I think we sort of narrativize it as. And so if you haven't seen Street Fighter, I would say like check it out and find out there's no middle ground on a film like this. And the only way you can really see where you land is by watching it for yourself. But of course, after I temper the recommendation, do we have any glaring pits to point out?
I've said it before, but the Blanca makeup is just it's like imagine if somebody had did a body paint job like on the old Incredible Hulk TV show and then just decided to throw a Carrot Top wig on top of it. That's basically what you have here. I mean, like, we are one step away from Yahoo Serious in a in a body paint job with the way he looks here. And it's also probably the one element that kind of goes nowhere. Like, there's all this buildup around, he's creating the super soldier. And what does Blanca actually do in this movie?
He kills old fat security man, and that's about it.
Exactly. It's just like, okay, that was a lot of buildup, for not a heck of a lot, ultimately. So I would say it's kind of my first day, pit. But what about you, Andrew? What do you have?
I would say it's not so much the performance as the character of Guile. I don't like, in the sense that he's a very reactionary character. He's a throwback to the classic action man, but he's also just a jerk to everybody. Like, there's nothing likable about the character of Guile. And I mean, it's 1994, and I feel like he's a very Rob Liefeld kind of character, where if you gave a 14-year-old, like, teenage boy a typewriter, and you said, "I want you to write dialogue for a cool, tough guy," I feel like that would be the dialogue and behaviors that Guile, the character, displays here. It's just, this film is so weird, but I don't want to just treat all weirdness as bad. And like, even in
No.
talking through it, like the aspects that I thought were discordant or not really integrated with the film as a whole, I'm like, but now I do kind of make sense of everything. Like it's weird because for a film that we can both agree isn't all that good, I'm really hard pressed to think of like egregious examples of the film going wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the only two things I could really come to mind that maybe would be the case is when you think about it with the film, really, Carlos Blanca, if he has one person you should be really mad at, it's Guile. Because
Oh
if
yeah, he
Guile
wouldn't
hadn't
have been
started.
identified. Yeah.
If Guile hadn't started shouting his name on TV, like, good one, Guile. You've got your own best friend killed.
Also
Although
with
I do love.
Blanca, I have another complaint about Blanca, so I think we've figured out where the film goes wrong. Guile, okay, Dalsim stops Guile from killing Blanca, saying that he doesn't have that right. You know, Blanca has the capacity for goodness and evil, and it's up to them to, like, let nature do its thing. And then Blanca immediately uses his newfound freedom by choosing to die, and Dalsim has no problem with that. So why intervene then?
I honestly don't know. It is really one of the more nonsensical plot points.
Yeah, in a film full of nonsense, like that's one of the only things jumping out as outright nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the only other thing that really I would that maybe goes a step too far is Bison's video game arcade controls
Oh,
for his
that is
legs.
groaningly bad, yeah. Because he's
I mean,
using the arcade board from Street Fighter II as well to detonate proximity mines, which I'll have you know, David, don't require you to activate to set off. That's what the word proximity means.
it's but it's like one of those things. I again, to think of our the current president of the United States, I could easily see somebody, however, setting up a board for him. And just say, yeah, no, this runs the mines, and just nobody correcting it because at least it keeps them away from doing anything possibly damaging. But yeah, that is the step kind of too far in a film that I think, again, some people might say already goes way too far long before we get to that moment.
Well, yeah, it hits the ground running and it doesn't stop until it kicks subtlety backwards through a wall of televisions and then it explodes. So, this has been quite the interesting stop on our film strip this week. Which I guess the only thing left to do is open up the map and figure out where we're going next.
Well, I'll turn the wheel over to you, Andrew. I've been feeling like I want to go to sleep here in the corner till we get there.
All right.
But where are we going next?
Well, I mean, I was really tempted once I heard the idea of Van Damme and Rob Schneider weaponizing counterfeit jeans in the film and Knock Off. I thought we were going to go there, but I'm actually going to do a favor for my friend Dave because Wes Studi, who plays our man Sagat in Street Fighter, also appears in a little film called Heat, directed by Michael Mann, who I know David probably loves more than he actually loves most other people on the planet that he has met. So, as my gift to you, we are going to look at Michael Mann's Heat, the seminal De Niro Pacino heist thriller with every single person in Hollywood showing up at some point.
Thank you very much, Andrew. The thought is very much appreciated. So yeah, so that'll be our next episode, and boy, will this one give us plenty to chew on as well. Until then, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Why don't you say you take us out, Andrew?
Okay, well, yeah, this marks episode 3, so I think at this point we're going to have a website up at some point. In the meantime, though, Dave, where can people get in touch with you?
Well, I think at this point you can find me at 24 Panels on Twitter, and that's pretty much it, for now at least, until we have some sort of home base. What about you, Andrew? Anywhere that people can contact you as of yet?
Well, honestly, I haven't been using Twitter all that much, but I think by next episode, I will have a show-specific Twitter account, and when that happens, you can find me on there. Otherwise, you can find me on Facebook as Andrew Canegeezer, and if you can spell my last name, then I will happily add you as a friend. But yeah, so any points to wrap up on?
Why isn't the soundtrack to this movie on iTunes? I mean, seriously, I was looking for at least one or two tracks from this, including that wonderful, oddly out of place, memory tune that Guile listens to while watching video of his good friend Charlie and him on a terrible date in a military boat for some
Oh,
reason.
yeah, the soundtrack's great. Far Side is on there. Hammer is on there. It's just like everything else about the film, far better and more interesting than it had any reason to be.
Yeah,
But
and
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I tried finding that Hammer track on like a best of album or anything. Nowhere to be found on iTunes. So come on, somebody, get on that.
Well, yeah, if you can't think of any other reason to watch this movie, you will hear the Hammer track. So I guess that wraps it up for this week. And I'm Andrew Kanegeezer.
I'm Dave Babbitt.
And remember, everybody, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Bye, folks.